This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. They couldn't vote, they couldn't hold public office, but that didn't keep the elite women of the early days of our republic from a life of politics. My guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, historian Catherine Allgore, author of Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government. Allgore looked into the lives of women such as Dolly Madison. She analyzed their correspondence, their activities, and the culture of the day. She discovered that these women acted consciously to shape a sturdy foundation for a very young nation. Listeners, I encourage your questions and comments for Catherine Allgore. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Catherine Allgore is a winner of dissertation awards from Yale University and the Organization of American Historians. She is assistant professor of history at Simmons College. Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government, is published by University Press of Virginia. Again, our telephone numbers, 333-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Catherine Allgore, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello, Celeste.
Hi. In its infancy, this country really needed its women, not just for their contributions as wife and mother, sister and daughter. How important were these ladies of Washington?
Well, first let me say it's a great pleasure to talk with you, Celeste. And also I think there's something very fitting. Let me give you the picture. I'm talking to you in my office at Simmons College in Boston, the only state right now to have a female governor who's
yes.
also expecting twins. So I think the karma's good for this. I think it's very important to understand that certainly private family roles are important and women contributed. But what my work shows, I hope, is that in the early days of the federal government, women and men together participated in creating a system that was going to do several things. And one of the things it was going to do was secure the capital city in Washington and give this baby nation a stable capital. The second thing it was going to do was going to help the federal government create the structures and bureaucracy that it's going to need to be a nation state. And maybe the third thing, and this is the most ephemeral thing of all, Celeste, but maybe the most important, it's going to create an idea in the minds of these new Americans and in outsiders that this really was a nation and it was here to stay.
Mm. An idea that we are citizens of this country called America. We are Americans.
Yes, indeed. And we're so used to it and we take so much stuff for granted, like that we have a government that takes care of certain things for us, that our capital stays in one place, that we're a democracy, that politics gets done, and that we're Americans. All that stuff that we're born into and take for granted really got established in these early days. We call it the early republic. It's from about the end of the American Revolution to somewhere in the 19th century. My work looks up the first days of Washington from 1800 to 1832.
Mm-hmm. The first three decades.
Yeah.
You note that this time, this was a time that was both exhilarating and frightening.
Oh, can you imagine?
Talk with us about that. I mean,
well,
sure.
Well, no one had ever done this before.
Right? That's the exciting part, and I suppose that's also the frightening part. But in more practical terms, what was it like to sort of be in this time where, I mean, we think of political correctness as something that's happening in our life and time, but boy, political correctness was right there at the outset.
It's sort of an extreme version. It's the XFL version of political correctness, and indeed, this is what governments were rising and falling on. Primarily, the government model that people knew in Western Europe and in America was a monarchy, where there's a king and some sort of aristocracy, and then there's the great unwashed mass of everybody else. And this is also the time, though, because this is really the birth of the modern nation state, where people were starting to think about other kinds of government. And the one that our founding generation wanted, the one, in fact, that they fought for in the American Revolution, was a government powered by a theory called republicanism. And Celeste, that's republicanism with a small R, let me tell you. But it contained lots of notions that are familiar to us in our politics. And republicanism wanted to do away with courts and kings and an absolute state power. And instead, it wanted to invest the ruling power of a state in its people. Now, if you're going to do that, you better make sure your people are virtuous, which was a concern of Republican theory. And you also better make sure that the people who rule you, your king or your queen, are weak in power. And so, you know, there's a very famous incident where John Adams is starting to argue in the early Congresses for the president, for instance, to have titles, a title. I think he wanted something like Most Benign Serene Highness or something. And everybody was terrified that there would be titles and there would be an aristocracy. They wanted to get as far as possible from anything that smacked of a court or a monarchy.
So they were horrified by the idea of aristocracy, but
oh, yeah.
yet they were also afraid of small d democracy.
Well, now there's the dilemma, isn't it? The flip side, the bad side of investing your power in the people is that the people often are not virtuous. I don't know if you've noticed that. And they can get quite carried away with themselves. So they were quite afraid of democracy. But there's also another problem, too, which is that, okay, you can fight a war against kings and courts and all that, but it turns out, the founding generation discovered, they were pretty darn useful. I mean, if you want to do those three things that I said, you know, if you want to establish a nation, if you want to set up a government structure or bureaucracy, and if you want to have a powerful capital city, you really do need those kinds of courtly things. So they were really caught between a rock and a hard place. They had this Republican experiment that nobody was sure was going to last, that badly needed all of these functions, but the only language of power that they knew was court power, and they'd already said they didn't want that.
So then political life was supposed to appear unpolitical, and so men were participating above ground, appearing unpolitical, while women were underground and very political.
Yes, I sort of even say parallel structures, because they're actually sort of in the same space, but doing different things, all toward the same end of securing the government. So if you were a congressman and you went to Washington, you had to make sure that you appeared like a good Republican, a virtuous man. And one of the things that you would want to do is avoid any suggestion that you were playing politics. So you would avoid, you know, anything that looked like a conspiracy or collusion. Well, the problem with that is, of course, we all know how politics gets done. People work together, especially in what's going to become a democracy. They form connections of interests and coalitions, and they work within structures. And so the official men are standing up in Congress, and they're saying, oh, I would never agree to do something that was against the public good. I'd never want to appear interested. But at the same time, this congressman's wife or his daughter are doing the sorts of things that secure these coalitions of interests. And to be really specific, if I can get down to the concrete, one of the great examples is patronage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, patronage, of course, is a dirty word to us, but but patronage, which is really the giving away of goodies to your political friends and supporters, makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, certainly if you go into power, you want to be surrounded by friends and not by enemies. But patronage is one of those things that kings and courts did. You know, they would give away favors, and it was all very personal and all of that. And so one of the, you know, tenets of the early republic was no patronage, no patronage, no fear or favor. And so the women of Washington became the premier influence peddlers. And they were the ones that gave away jobs and created these networks of favors that make politics work. Now, I want to say these women were not feminists or radicals, Celeste. These were very conservative, middling class, elite class white women who saw their work not as some incredibly, you know, innovative political, you know, frontiering, but rather working toward their families. And what they were doing, for instance, giving away jobs and making sure that legislation got pushed through, was something that men and women had always done together. It's just that for this brief window of time, between 1800 to 1832, the men of these families couldn't do it, and the women could.
Didn't everyone know what was going on?
This is what was so hard for me to understand, Celeste. And the other question is, didn't they, the women themselves, know what they're doing?
Right.
And this is when I found out the truism of those 12-step programs, which is denial ain't just a river in Egypt. The culture was very invested on denying that women had power. I mean, they were afraid of courts, right? Mm-hmm. And we all remember Marie Antoinette and what happened to her. But in courts, women always wielded a great deal of power, you know, queens and courtesans and just court ladies. And so the leaders of this new republic, most notably the one I pick on most is Thomas Jefferson, just did not want women anywhere near power. And the women themselves, if you read their words, they say, oh, I'm not interested in politics, I don't understand politics, it is not fitting for my sex to interest themselves in politics. And for a while I thought, well, I'm obviously on the wrong track. But then I realized that often when these women would say these things, what would follow would then be politics. But as long as they kept up this sort of culture of denial, as long as they issued a disclaimer, and as long as everybody pretended not to notice what they were doing, they could do it. And so my women, and this is ironic, isn't it? They are operating politically by using the roles of wife and mother and by disavowing any interest in politics.
Hmm. I want to continue here talking about this period, but before, at this point, what I want to ask you about is your governor there in Massachusetts. We're talking about these two spheres, the official sphere and the unofficial sphere, official space, unofficial space. Mm-hmm. And she seems to me to be having a hard time, being given a hard time at least, negotiating those two spheres.
I don't think so, actually.
Really?
Because
okay.
She's very much a denizen of the official sphere. What they are trying to do is bring in private issues from about, what we consider private issues about family, and they're trying to put them into the official space. But when you get elected or appointed to office and you draw a salary, as far as I'm concerned, you're in the official sphere. When people started, you know, attacking your sex life or talking about your procreative life, I think that's something different. I contend, and I'm not the first one or the best one to do this, that for politics to operate successfully, you need an official sphere. And the official sphere is the sphere of legislation and signatures on papers and elected officials. But you also need an unofficial sphere. And it's in the unofficial sphere that officials and not officials can work out compromises, they can wheel and deal, they can actually do the stuff that makes politics happen. And you can't have politics without both. You can't have just one. You just can't have an official sphere. You need a place. And for us, mostly, the unofficial sphere unfolds in a place that is what we fancy academics would call gendered, that is, a female space. The unofficial sphere of our politics happens at social events where we not only expect women, they're absolutely necessary, and in my period, in the parlors of ladies and in other private spaces in the house. And so that's really what I mean by the unofficial sphere. It's a place for politics. Jane Swift is definitely part of the official sphere.
Hmm. Unofficial space is less populated these days.
I'm sorry, the unofficial sphere is less populated,
yeah.
You say? Well, some of us left.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we can, I don't know, we might expect changes.
It's going to be terribly interesting because what has happened in the 20th century, of course, is that we women, I'm going to include us both here, we've been allowed access to the official sphere. We can go to college and we can get degrees and we can bring our wonderful ideas and talents into the official sphere. And you're right. Unfortunately, there's no population going into the unofficial sphere. And what I'm most interested in, of course, is our first woman president someday. But I'm also interested in seeing how the first woman president's spouse, which I assume will be a man, is going to handle the unofficial sphere.
Interesting.
I mean, there's literally, if you put it in a bald way, there's nobody at home to have the dinner party.
At the turn of the 19th century, Washington was Washington City. What was the city like at the outset of the 19th century?
It was a blank canvas, waiting to be filled in. And in some ways, it was the perfect city. Jefferson loved it, to create a government from the ground up, from scratch. There were no castles, no courts, literally no corridors of power. It was a rural landscape that had county seats. There were people there. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't depopulated. There were Maryland and Virginia gentry around in the area, but there was no city. And so it was this perfect tabula rasa on which to begin this new project, this Republican government that had never before really existed in the modern world. And it was different even than, as you may know, the capital of the new United States had resided in New York and Philadelphia, which were comparatively old cities by, you know, United States standards. And they had, you know, the networks, they had their elites, they had the people who were involved in the economic, social, political life of the town. They were sort of like little baby courts. But Washington City, down south, in this rural landscape, was brand new. Now, it's an odd city. I think it's very beautiful now. But usually what happens with a city is that it starts with a small little city center and then it grows out. A kind of old-fashioned version of urban sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
But this city was created on paper. And so on paper, it looked very grand, and it covered, you know, a specific plot of ground, and it had buildings etched in. But then when you went to the city, you could be standing in the middle of it, Celeste, and not know it, because all of this was just a dream at that time.
And life for women in Washington City was more public than for women in other cities. Why was that?
Yes, at some point I sort of sketched a picture of this life, and someone said to me, man, it sounds like Disneyland for women. Well, most Americans lived in really in small towns and on farms, and you know, there was not a lot of diversion, not a lot of fashion, not a lot of connection to the outside world. Then, of course, there were some women who lived in cities like Boston and Charleston and Philadelphia, and they were much more connected to the urban, you know, life and the good ideas and the new fashions. But in these old cities, there were places they could not go for safety's sake, and also places where it wasn't proper for them to go. Women in Philadelphia, New York, didn't sort of drop by the counting house or the bank or the seat of government and just kind of hang out. But Washington was this place where women could travel very freely, and they could go to the House of Representatives, they could go to the Senate and watch debates, they could go to the Supreme Court, and they did, and they would travel in droves. And if it got boring in Congress, which apparently some things never change, it got boring in Congress, they would just move on, and they had an incredible freedom of movement. You have to understand, too, that when women came to Washington, they left their ordinary lives behind them back wherever they were, upstate New York or mm-hmm. Boston, Massachusetts, and they would come to the capital city, often without their children or with grown children, and they would live with their husbands in boarding houses where, and I hope you can appreciate this as much as I do, somebody cleaned for them and cooked for them. So here are these women who are suddenly freed from domestic duties, cooking, cleaning, and child rearing, in the city where they're free to travel anywhere they want. And what do they get to see? They get to see the most exciting stuff of all. They get to see the drama of government unfolding. And Congress is pretty tumultuous at that time, so there was plenty of drama to see. Also, there was a strong European presence. It was the capital of the United States, after all. And so there were diplomats and ministers and travelers, and anybody who was anybody went to Washington City. So it is starting to sound a bit like Disneyland. It's very exciting, very colorful, and these women, freed from their domestic duties, could participate.
Yeah, fascinating. These women include women such as Mrs. James Madison, Dolly.
Queen Dolly.
What a fabulous woman. Her husband was inaugurated in 1809. What was the nation's state of affairs when Dolly became First Lady?
Well, Dolly and James had been in the city right from the start in 1800 for those first 9 years. James served as Thomas Jefferson's Secretary of State. And Thomas Jefferson had no official First Lady, and Dolly Madison, who was a wonderful society person, a social person, and a master politician, may I say, served as sort of the nation's hostess in that capacity. So by the time James and Dolly took over the White House in 1809, she was, you know, pretty much a longtime resident and knew the city, even in its kind of infant state. And actually, it was a pretty rough time. This was the lead-up. 1809 is the lead-up tensions with Britain that are going to culminate in the War of 1812, which was a disastrous war. The capital city was not in good shape, too. Part of the problem was this quality. I said it was like a dream, and some people thought of the Americans as dreaming children, that they planned to have this capital city, but it was in pretty much of a mess. And, in fact, the president's mansion, the executive mansion, what would later become, under Dolly's tenure, the White House, was probably a good metaphor for all of this. It was a mess.
It was falling down almost.
It was falling down, and it was shabby, and it wasn't finished. It was just like the capital city, and in some ways, sort of like the fate of the nation. I mean, you know, Britain is making problems. There's troubles in the Congress. Nobody can agree on anything. Things were kind of shaky and dim when the Madisons took over. But fortunately for the fate of the country, James Madison, who was in some ways a wonderful administrator, had married Dolly Payne Todd Madison.
Where would we be today without Queen Dolly?
Well, I think as a professional historian, I'm not allowed to speculate like that. Unless, of course, we're sitting in a bar over a couple of drinks. But let me say this. It might be that the capital city might not be in Washington, and it might be that in the transition to wherever it was going to move, the nation could have been in deep peril.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had a pretty clear agenda from the start, and I take it very seriously when I call her a master politician. Dolly comes to us famous as being a hostess. And for us, as modern people of the 20th century, we don't understand hostess. We think of somebody passing around, I don't know, plates of canapes. But a hostess was somebody who was a powerful woman who melded and brought together political and social leaders and helped to create a culture of at least of an elite upper class. And in Dolly's case, of course, this is all happening at the federal government level. So, for instance, using social events when she got into her office as First Lady, she brought members of the local community, those gentry families I was telling you about, into the circle and wove them into the government. She brought lots of people together, legislators and people who had projects together in her social events so that they could make politics as well. She bound people to herself through her charisma and her skill to help support her husband during these very contentious times. And for the first time in our history, the nation's capital became a presence in the minds of Americans. And as I said, the president's mansion even got a nickname. It was the White House. And people started coming there and visiting. And all of this is going to pay off, tragically, in a kind of big way, in 1814 when the British burned the White House and sacked the capital. The British were hoping that this would just discourage the Americans. But it had the opposite effect. Thanks to Dolly's efforts, people were just sort of outraged by this, and they rallied around the Capitol. And when some legislators tried to move the Capitol from Washington to another location, and it would have been months before the federal government would have been back on its feet, Dolly rallied her supporters from the local community to keep the Capitol in Washington.
Fascinating story. Catherine Allgaier is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her book, Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your participation in the discussion this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us on Line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Wonderful topic. I was wondering if you have, Professor, studied, were there differences in parlor politics between the northern women and the southern women, the whole concept of the southern women being more isolated, and was it a freeing agent for when they came to Washington, D.C., that they had a lot more say in what went on, and did that help influence any of the governments? And I'll take my answer off the air.
What a great question. There are regional differences. The period that I'm talking about, though, even though the North is slightly more urban than the South, it's not that big a difference. I think what's significant is that, and maybe it's the dirty secret of our history, but the early federal government was largely Southern. And it was women like Dolly Madison who came and were most successful because they brought with them traditions of Southern hospitality, culture, and gentry practices, and they applied them to the federal government. This is not to say that there were not some formidable Northern women who knew how to play politics as well, and we can talk about some of them, but it is true that the Southern women brought a certain kind of culture to the nation's capital and made it work for them. If I can give you an example about, well, actually it's about something Dolly's really famous for, which is ice cream. Part of her agenda for Americanizing the capital was that she wanted to serve an American table. She wanted to have regional foods from all over. And this is a custom among Southern women to exchange recipes. So Dolly Madison solicited recipes from elites, actually all across the country, and then she offered, as her own sort of, you know, coin of the realm, the recipe for that very famous, very rare dessert, which was ice cream.
Interesting. I want to go back to the White House, and she had her work cut out for her, as you mentioned. The White House was a disaster. She set out to make the executive mansion a national symbol, and she did that through metaphor and paint. How important a task was overseeing the decoration of the president's house?
Yeah, you know, that's one of those things you see in every First Lady book, which is that Dolly Madison redecorated the White House. And we think we understand that because to us, redecorating is a sort of, it's just like putting something on top of something. It's something that women do. It's natural for women to do it. But at that time, it had a very different meaning. Houses were not private spaces. They weren't havens in a heartless world. They were public buildings. They were the places where the business of an area got done. If you came to America or any town in Western Europe and you had a book to sell or you wanted a pulpit or you were trying to get a job, you would walk into a town and you would literally look up, and there'd be that house on the hill. And that's where you would go as a lawyer, or if you were going to buy or sell slaves, you would go to that house on the hill. So houses of the gentry folk had a very different function than they do now. And of course, the gentry folk, who always want to convince us that they are the right people to rule us, use imposing houses. They use architecture. They use material possessions, things like tea sets, to convince folks that they are the better sort of folk. Mm. And so if you think about it, what was happening in Washington was just that, except writ large. And instead of thinking of redecorating the White House, what Dolly Madison did was really restructure it. She worked with Henry Latrobe in fashioning several public rooms that, again, they weren't supposed to be places where she and her husband could relax or, you know, just enjoy, you know, quiet company. But they were public rooms where people could actually meet and interact and begin to create these extra official structures that the federal government sorely needed.
And style and substance, this is a very interesting discussion in your book. Style and substance go hand in glove.
Absolutely. Of course they do. I mean, how you're ruled makes you understand what, well, how we're ruled is important to us. If somebody has a democratic style, right, the substance then is that there's democracy. If somebody has a tyrannical style, the substance is tyranny. One of the problems in doing this work that I had to learn, I had to let the ladies of Washington teach me, is I'm a modern person, and I have notions about how life is ordered and how things go. And I think these notions are, you know, old and natural like everybody else, but of course they're not. They came to us in the 19th century, and so I'm talking about notions that there's a private sphere and a public sphere, that style is different from substance, that men and women occupy, you know, certain realms of the world, that families function in certain ways. All of these notions that we have in the 20th century and the 21st century come from the 19th century, but it's different for these women. They're right. They're sort of right before that time, and they're elites as well. And so they don't separate style and substance. They don't separate public and private. They don't even separate men and women's worlds in the way that we sort of assumed that they did. So when Dolly Madison is trying to convince people that this really is a nation and it is worthy of attention and it's safe, how she does it is, for instance, she dresses like a queen. She doesn't just dress well, Celeste. She dresses like a queen. And it's not because she wants people particularly to just admire her or to think, wow, it's fabulous outfits. But rather, they want to say, oh, yes, this is a place where power is housed and is being administered correctly.
And Dolly Madison saw the White House as national symbol and also as a place that was a working state house.
Indeed. During Jefferson's time, very few people actually got to go to the president's mansion. He's very famous for having these very small, intimate dinners where he really exerted rigid control. I mean, there were small, intimate little dinner parties because he basically didn't want anybody talking about something that he didn't know about. And because they were small, somebody in Congress, a congressman or so, might get there maybe once a season, once a year. And Jefferson discouraged big events. He didn't want to have, because they were too much like courts. Courts had these big events where lots of people would come and play politics. And Jefferson, again, he was a bit of a control freak. And he didn't want, you know, lots of people using the White House for their own, you know, advantage. So he had really two big parties a year on the 4th of July and on New Year's Day. But when Dolly Madison came to town, she knew that it was in her interest and her husband's interest to not just play politics themselves, but to create a political culture where people would, in which people could be invested because they were getting something out of it. And so she instituted something that she called drawing rooms. And they happened during the season, which would be anywhere from November to March in Washington, where the Congress was sitting. They would happen once a week, regularly, and everybody was invited to come. And they did. The first invitations to these drawing rooms were put into the newspaper, and Americans from all classes and all walks of life who happened to be in the city would come. And they would have refreshments. They were very much like modern cocktail parties. It was very much sort of on the move. People, you could be part of a group, and then the group would break up, and you would move to a new group. And, of course, what people discovered was that you could further your own political interests there. And so this was a wonderful example of how she used the social sphere to create political structures and coalitions among Washington legislators, congressmen, families, the local and the official communities, and pretty much everybody who came to Mrs. Madison's drawing room.
Networking big time.
Networking big time. And that's not a bad thing, Celeste. That is how politics gets done. People have to be persuaded that they have interests that lie together and that they're for the public good, but they also might be getting something, you know, out of it themselves, even if it's just the great feeling that you have when you're doing something altruistic. And Dolly Madison recognized this, and she made it work, fortunately for all of our benefits.
And at this time, it was critical for men in Washington, in public life, to have their wives with them in the city. I think you quote some fellow is saying, without my wife, I am like, you know, half of a scissors, a broken scissors.
Well, yes, and indeed, that's one of the stereotypes I think that my work has gone a little bit toward dispelling, which is that there weren't women in Washington. In the very, very first year or so, there were a few women in Washington. But women started coming, and of course I'm talking about these white, middling, and elite women. They started coming right from the beginning, and then it became, you know, as the years passed, we're talking about 1809 and 1812 and 1816, which is when Thomas Hubbard from upstate New York says that, it becomes very clear that the women are absolutely needed because they do this crucial work. For instance, there's not a lot of legislation that's happening really at this time in the federal government. This is a time of a very small, weak federal government. Some of us may long for that time again, but this is certainly that time. And so there's no big, like, you know, tax bills, and there's no big, you know, public projects. There's not a lot of what we would understand as really big legislation. So what is one of the, what are they doing there? And one of the things that they're doing in one of their legislative genres is they're getting stuff, congressmen, they're getting stuff for their constituents. And so what they're getting is maybe a political project that a constituent wants passed, or a pension from the Revolutionary War, or perhaps some sort of reimbursement because of the war. There's a lot of business with ordinary Americans. And that can kind of be a little dicey, you know, because that kind of looks like self-interest. You know what I mean? These are the people that are electing you, and you're getting them some cash. Might not look good. Well, women proved an invaluable mediator in this process. And sometimes when a man felt like he just couldn't go to Congress one more time with this particular guy's or this particular constituent's request, he would have his wife lobby the other men in the boarding houses. And sometimes these were transactions often between women. So it would be a woman from a constituent family who would appeal to a woman of a legislator family, and she would, you know, process that request. So you really needed to have a woman with you in order to function maximally. Remember that when you're a congressman and you're elected and you're sent to Washington, you have two jobs. And one is you have to secure your place in this new capital. You've got to build a little power structure right there in Washington. But you also can't forget the folks back home, because after all, they're the ones that sent you there. And women proved really invaluable at doing both of these things. So if you brought your wife to Washington, she would arrange social events. She would call on other wives, and she would help put you into that network of power. And she would also act as a mediator between you and the constituents at home.
And women saw this as a great opportunity for themselves and their families. And it's interesting that there's still all that denial going on.
I'm telling you, this is a very frustrating bunch of women, Celeste. Yes, very. I mean, a little time, sometimes I would find a little personal pride sneak through, or a little awareness sneak through. But for most of the time, the language of these really hardcore, influence-peddling, patronage-dealing women was coy and obscure and domestic. And if you weren't really reading carefully enough, you would think that it would be some sort of conversation between two women. Oh, Mrs. Randolph has written me a letter, and it just about broke my heart. The circumstances, she was so brave, but she didn't have to say, and I'm wondering. And then you read and you find out that what Mrs. Randolph, in this case I'm thinking of Martha Randolph, who's Thomas Jefferson's daughter, is asking a woman like Margaret Bayard Smith to do is get her son-in-law a job. And that is patronage and influence peddling.
Well, tell us about Margaret Bayard Smith.
She was extraordinary to discover. Margaret Bayard Smith is a rarity and a historian's dream. She comes to Washington in 1800 as a young bride. She's married to her cousin, actually, Samuel Harrison Smith, and she's a convert. She comes from a very Federalist family, very sort of high-toned elite family, but she's a convert to her husband's political religion, which is Jeffersonian Republicanism. And indeed, the reason that Margaret Bayard Smith and Samuel Harrison Smith come to Washington in 1800 is that Thomas Jefferson wants young Samuel to found and run a newspaper. And this newspaper is called the Daily Intelligencer, and it actually is the precursor to the Congressional Record. So this is where the debates from Congress, you know, are printed, and it's really a great source for lots of information about the government at this time. But Margaret Bayard Smith, it turns out, was an extremely prolific and talented writer. And in a day when women weren't professionals, she was a professional writer. She wrote a reportage, she wrote fiction, she got published. But what's most valuable to us is that in 1800, she begins a correspondence with her two sisters and some of her sisters-in-law that's going to last the whole time she's in Washington. And she is in Washington, Celeste, for 44 years. And that's astonishing, because Washington was even more a city of transients than it is now. And for someone to stay there on the scene for 44 years, and they're a talented writer, man, that was wonderful. And so what I mean, she was just a wonderful source for all of this stuff. And she was intensely curious and intensely observant. And she emerges over the decades, as time goes by, as a premier influence peddler. Not only does she place her relatives in good positions, but she gets known as a person who gets stuff done. And she had many, many what I would call non-kin men and the women of their family coming to her for help.
How did you learn of her?
I originally was introduced to her because in the early 20th century, so like 1904 or 5, a man named Gayard Hunt published a collection of her letters, tiny little selection of them. and it's called The First 40 Years of Washington Society. And pretty much it was chatty letters about famous guys. But I was suspecting that there was something more. Then I was very lucky, and I met a wonderful scholar named Frederick Atoida, who is part of the Institute of Early American Culture in Williamsburg. And she was talking about Margaret Baird Smith, and she had some interesting ideas. And then I went to the Library of Congress and found Margaret Baird Smith's papers, which are enormous. This is a woman who wrote, you know, every day, pages and pages, for 44 years. And as I said, this book from 1905 or something only had this tiny little selection. And it was reading Margaret Baird Smith's work that just, you know, laid out the whole kind of history of Washington City. And again, people have been so wonderful and generous. I met a woman named Rose Barquist, who's a scholar of Margaret Baird Smith, who was eager to share her ideas with me. And a host of really welcoming women scholars to help me understand what I was finding. But she really was. I mean, Dolly Madison is famous and fabulous and wonderful, but Margaret Baird Smith really provides the pulse beat of this work because of her her incredible talent.
Might we expect to see a book featuring her correspondence?
I think actually pretty soon. In fact, Frederick Atoida and Joyce Appleby, who is, as you know, a preeminent historian of America, are releasing a sort of selected correspondence, you know, less on the great names and much more on the kind of interesting political, social stuff. And certainly Frederick Atoida is working on a book about Margaret Baird Smith, I think mostly from a literary point of view. My next project, as a matter of fact, I became so intrigued by these women, is a political biography of Dolly Madison.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of calling it Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is book, because in the book Parlor Politics that I have out now, in each chapter, you meet a certain, like a different woman or a different set of women, and I offer all these ways of maybe studying women. And Dolly Madison seems to me as the perfect case study. So I want to take these models that I've proposed and got to play with for about a chapter and really apply them to Dolly. And I'm calling it a political biography because I don't really want to do like a Life and Times. Mm-hmm. I really want to do her political work. But as I guess you're getting the idea, I tend to include things like clothing and jewelry and other kinds of unexpected elements in my political analysis. So it won't exactly be like a book about FDR.
Well, style and substance is very important in, when it comes to Dolly Madison.
Yes, ma'am. And I would argue with everybody.
You know, I'm thinking of all the wonderful work that is coming down the pike these days regarding women and history. Just recently, Fanny Kemble, a biography of her and her journals, an edited book of her journals came out. A fascinating story. Fanny Kemble being an actress and a writer who lived in the later 19th century. She
married into the slaveholding South.
Right. Right.
Yes, and so she brought that intelligence, talent, and outsider's perspective to the South.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Celeste, this is not your father's political history.
No, it's not.
and that's the important thing, too, is that we're not just uncovering women and showing how they contributed to this sphere. This is, I guess, where we began. But really how the sphere of politics could not be the way it is without the efforts of these men and women. Part of this is about gender, that is about women's work. Part of it is about class. This was a generation of people, well, I know that somebody else took this phrase, but what is it, the finest generation, the greatest generation? This really is the greatest generation, as a matter of fact, because they're putting together this country, and it's something that men and women do in male and female ways. So sometimes females in my period act in very male ways. They go right to the guy in the office and they demand something. And certainly lots of men in the period that I study acted in female ways. That is, they walked around social events with a drink in their hand schmoozing. So we have to see this to understand actually how things work. And the problem with having so many wonderful women to study is that you could kind of get lulled into a sense that these are exceptional women, that Dolly Madison's is sort of, you know, wonderful and exceptional and never, you know, never to be repeated. But what I really wanted to convey in the book, and I hope I have, is that this is a structure, this is a system that depends on the work of women, and that these are women for whom politics is the family business. And in the same way that women ran farms and were shopkeepers and printing and printers and printing presses. This is a family business, and women work at it.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, Catherine.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Catherine Allgaier has been our guest this afternoon. She is the author of Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington help build a city and a government. The book is published by University Press of Virginia.